remorse. If you have remorse, you are imprisoned by that remorse. That remorse makes your mind dark. It makes your mind slightly negative. It makes your mind, all these negative states of mind that arise from that. And you are imprisoned by those states of mind. If your mind is bright, if your mind is positive and optimistic about things because you've done the right things, that feeling is a feeling of liberation from the negative states. So virtue leads to freedom. It does not lead to imprisonment. So people, you know, this idea that rules somehow imprison you is actually the exact reverse thing of what actually happens inside of yourself. It may be a slight narrowing down of the scope for what you can do for a short period of time, but the long-term effect of this is a freeing of the mind, and it's a very beautiful thing that happens. Sometimes we need certain restraint, a certain holding back, to gain a larger freedom that is much more important and much more powerful than the little restraint that we all otherwise have to do in life. So it's freeing, right? There's a beautiful saying by the Buddha that the Dhamma has one taste. Just like the ocean has only one taste, the taste of salt, the Dhamma has the taste of freedom. The Buddha's teaching has the taste of freedom. Whatever you do in the Dhamma, whatever follows in accordance with Dhamma is about freedom. Virtue is part of that. It leads to the sense of freedom. Buddhissa, or something like that. It's praised by the wise, right? Wise people praise virtuous behavior because they know that it leads to something good in the world, both for yourself and also for other people. It is ungrasped, it says here. This is because this is for the noble disciple, and the noble disciple doesn't need to grasp at virtue anymore. So if you are not a noble disciple, in other words, if you haven't got that profound insight into the Dhamma, which a noble disciple has, it means you're still going to have to hold on a little bit to the virtue. A little bit of grasping is okay, because if you have no holding on whatsoever, you're going to end up doing all kinds of bad things. So a little bit of holding on to the virtue is good. But for the noble disciple, virtue is natural. That's why they say for the noble disciple, you don't have to grasp, because it is natural, become a natural part of your personality. You cannot anymore do anything terribly wrong. You can still do small, minor things that are wrong, but you will then confess them straight away and sort it out, so to speak. But there is nothing, you are become pure as far as virtue is concerned. For the rest of us, grasping onto virtue is a good thing. It's like the sometimes the ladder you have to climb. You have to kind of hold on to one rung to be able to go up to the next one. Leading to concentration, leading to samadhi, leading to stillness of the mind, leading to unification of mind. Again, this is what we saw before, that virtue, which is practiced well, this is the clue. This is like the whole thing which actually takes you to good meditation practice. Virtue is what it's all about, just like we saw before, right? This is what makes meditation possible. Okay, so what happens then in the mind of a person when you do this in the right way? So when you do this, when you recollect your virtue in the right way, this is specifically for the noble disciple, but for everyone else it works in a little bit in the same way, not as powerfully, but a similar kind of thing is happening for everyone else as well. So when you do that, on that occasion, your mind is not obsessed by sensual desires. It says lust here, but lust is not such a good word. It's any kind of desire for pleasure through the senses, right? It's a much more broad term than lust. Hatred, you're not obsessed by hatred, not obsessed by anger, by negativity, all these kind of things. Nor are you obsessed by delusion. In other words, it means that these things, there might be a little bit left of these things, but it's very, very weak and it's hardly there at all. And on that occasion, your mind is straight, based on virtuous behavior. Mind is straight, Ujju in Pali. And why is the mind straight? And the reason is because when you have anger, when you have desires in the mind, the mind is called bent in Buddhism, right? It's bent according to the anger. You don't see things clearly. You see things in accordance with the anger instead. The anger tells you, this is how you should look at the world. This is what you should be seeing. And you will see in that accordance with that. So your mind is bent. You can't see clearly. Desire is the same problem. Delusion is the same problem. Your mind is not seeing things straight. So once you overcome these hindrances too, and they become very weak, your mind is starting to become straight. For the first time, you can actually start to see things properly. You understand how virtue fits into the path, you understand why virtue is so powerful, and this is what you're seeing at this particular point. Your mind is straight. And because it is straight, that is why it says here, you gain inspiration in the meaning, inspiration in the Dhamma. So the meaning here is like the goal, the purpose of the practice. It's called atta in Pali language. It's why we're doing this. It's what we're moving towards. So you're getting inspiration in the goal. Why? Because you're starting to see the goal, right? You're starting to see that when I am virtuous, my mind is becoming straight. I can see clearly. And one of the things that you see is the power of virtue, why it works, why it is so important. And that is the straightness of the mind here. And that is because you see the causality yourself in your mind, that's why you get inspiration in the purpose of the virtue. You understand what's going on. And because you understand what's going on, you also get inspiration in the teachings, right? In the Dhamma, because this is obviously all connected with Dhamma. This is the teaching of the Buddha. You start to see, wow, this is a very powerful teaching. And you start to feel inspired. You start to feel uplifted by these teachings. As long as you have anger, as long as you have desire, as long as you have all these other things there, it's very hard to feel uplifted. You can't, because you can't see the connection. Once you see the connection, once you see these things, then the uplift comes. It's only then that these things really inspire you. And when you feel inspired, that is where gladness comes, right? Inspiration, gladness comes from that, or it's even part of that. And then you can see that mindfulness is also part of this, because when you are glad, wow, the present moment, everything is so wonderful, you stay in the present moment, and then this whole thing starts to work as a consequence of that. Then this whole path comes into operation that I was talking about before. From that joy, from the inspiration comes the joy, from the joy, the rapture, from the rapture, tranquility of the body, from the tranquility of the body, the deep pleasure, the sukha. From the sukha comes the samadhi. The whole path works as a consequence. So you can see here how this works. So one thing I should perhaps just mention briefly, it says here again, it uses the word recollect. You are recollecting your virtuous behavior. And I think the main thing here, as I said just previously, is it is a natural recollection. It's not something that you have to strive very hard to do. You don't have to force yourself to think about these things. It's like the shadow, the mountain of good actions, right? Talking about the shadow of the mountain before. The mountain of good actions kind of casts its shadow over you, so you just feel good quite naturally. That is one way of looking at it. Recollection can also be a little bit more active. It can be like you just sit back in your chair or whatever, and you just allow, you tell your mind, or you tell yourself, mind, take me back to something good I have done, right? And you just wait. You don't kind of force yourself, you just wait till something comes up, something nice. And then you just get the feeling, what does it feel like? And you just get that feeling up. You don't kind of linger in the past or anything like that, but you tune into that feeling that arose in the past or arises now simply by remembering, the good things, the virtues, the precepts you have been keeping. That's all you do. And then perhaps you bring up some of the other teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha says these wonderful things that if you are keep the five precepts in the world, if you are a kind person, you give beings a freedom from fear, right? There's nothing to fear from you. If you don't kill beings, if you don't steal, if you don't commit sexual misconduct, if you don't lie, nobody has anything to fear from you. You're not going to take anybody for a ride. You're not going to deceive anyone. You're always going to be honest. You're always going to be kind. And you're giving that freedom of fear to other people and animals alike. What a wonderful gift that is. It's a deep psychological gift that you're giving to others. It's a wonderful thing to give. So remember that. And remember these kind of teachings. It makes you so happy that you're doing this, because you're actually giving something very precious and beautiful to the world. It's nice to give material things, but to give a kind of psychological comfort and psychological ease is a very powerful thing to do. So all of these things will then make you feel a sense of gladness about what you're doing. And it becomes very, very good in that way. Yeah. So, and when you do this, then it says here, the noble disciple dwells in balance amidst an unbalanced population. You're in balance because your mind is now at ease. It's relaxed. It's not being pulled by desire and craving and anger, but it's actually, it's kind of neutral, and you feel at peace, right? There's no, all these drives inside of you are, for a while at least, they are come to an end, and you're just balanced. In an unbalanced population, most people tend to be run around by craving, desires, and all these kind of things. You're unafflicted in an afflicted population. Desire is an affliction, right? It's like a heat. It's something that burns you inside. If you are truly at peace, truly relaxed, then you can see the coolness and the beauty of that, rather than being afflicted by anger, by desires. It's a coolness, a beauty to that. This is what happens. You are less afflicted, and for that reason, you have much, much less suffering than other people have in the world. So, this is how you recollect your virtuous behavior. Someone who has entered the stream, it says here, well, this is why we're talking about the noble disciple, is someone who is already an Arya, as they say, so someone who has seen the profound Dhamma in a direct way. But it's true for all of us, even if just for a slightly lesser extent, perhaps. Okay, so that is the first way. Again, you can see here, what I'm trying to point out is the connection between virtue and meditation, right? This is what this is all about. How does virtue lead into meditation, into samadhi? That is the first one. The second one here is how generosity leads into samadhi. It's a very similar kind of principle. But it's good to know, because it kind of, again, it gives you a little bit more oomph to your practice of generosity here. So this is how this works. So Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects his own generosity thus. It is truly my good fortune and gain that in a population obsessed by the stain of miserliness, I dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of miserliness, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to charity, delighted in giving and sharing. When a noble disciple recollects his generosity, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, hatred, or delusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on generosity. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, rapture arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes still or unified or attains samadhi. This is called a noble disciple who dwells in balance amidst an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of generosity. Okay. So again, you see exactly the same process at work, the process that leads to samadhi, but this time the basis for that process, instead of being just ordinary virtue, in this case it's based on generosity. Of course, there isn't really any distinction between generosity and virtue, right? They go together, part and parcel of the broader thing we might just call kindness, basically. But generosity is a kind of a very more specific type of virtue, specific type of characteristics. So this is specifically about that. And that is because generosity, as such, can have a very powerful impact on the mind. When you do an act of charity, it can be very, very powerful in its own right. And that's why it's singled out in this way. What the Buddha says here is that this is how you think. It is truly my good fortune and gain that in a population obsessed by the stain of miserliness, I dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of miserliness, right? So you think of yourself how fortunate you are, that you are generous. You don't think of how great you are or what a wonderful person. You don't kind of boost your ego with this. You think, wow, I understand the power of generosity. I understand how much happiness it gives me. I understand that it actually supports my meditation practice. And I can see that in myself. And then you feel so lucky that you have discovered this. You feel so lucky that you can see the connection between generosity and meditation. Wow, all these other people some of them are miserly. Some of them haven't understood this. And you feel a sense of compassion for them, right? It's easy to see someone who might be very miserly and you might get upset. They have money, they can always help out more. You see some of these very wealthy people sometimes, or even ordinary people who could help out a little bit, and they are miserly. But instead of getting upset, you feel a sense of compassion. They are missing out. They had this enormous possibility of creating so much happiness and joy for themselves and also for others. They're not actually getting that possibility. They don't understand. Isn't that a wonderful way? Instead of getting upset, you have a sense of compassion for these people, a sense of it's a shame they're not taking the opportunity. And this is the right way of thinking about generosity. Wow, how fortunate I am that I have seen this and I have understood this. And you can see here that this is a very high standard here, right? You dwell, you're freely generous. It means that this is about the noble disciple. In other words, once you become a noble disciple, that hindrance of miserliness has completely disappeared. You always want to give. You always want to give out. You always want to support others. And you can see that when somebody is very developed in the Dhamma, they are often very, very, very generous. There is a very interesting rule in the Buddhist monastic code for monks. I'm not sure if the nuns have that rule, but anyway, it's certainly there for the monks. I don't think the nuns have it, actually. But it's a rule that says that if someone is an Aryan disciple who supports the monastic order, then you have an obligation to say enough is enough of giving. Because sometimes they give so much that they can't feed their children anymore. That's literally what it says there. You are so open-handed. You don't actually keep enough money for yourself, right? This is kind of your desire to be generous has kind of gone overboard a little bit. You don't actually keep enough for yourself. So the monastic order has an obligation to not go to that family if they know that they will be giving too much, right? This is kind of the degree to which some people would be generous if they understand the power of generosity. So this is what is meant here. It's a very, very high standard. But we can all kind of understand to some degree what is happening here. Open-handed, delighting in relinquishment. Every time you give, you feel, wow, how wonderful it is. Devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. And this is what I was saying yesterday. When you do an act of generosity, where does it feel natural, right? Where is it easy for you to give? You shouldn't think, where can I get the most return? I know that sometimes people have this calculating mind. And the problem with some of the countries in the Buddhist countries that have been Buddhist countries for a long time is that very often they have very kind of set views about certain things. And I know that certain places, they often kind of become very calculating about generosity, right? If I give to this person is maybe has attained so and so much, I should give there, I should not go here, right? I should start calculating where you get the most merit out of generosity. How can I get the most in return? But if you do that, you're missing the point. It's not going to work that way. Because the way it works, it has to come from the heart, right? It's beautiful when it comes from the heart. So don't worry too much about where you give. The Buddha was once asked, where should I give? That was King Pasenadi who asked him. You should give where it comes naturally. You should give where your heart inclines. That is where you should give. If that inclination is to a Buddhist cause, wonderful. Of course it's great to give to Buddhism. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But if you happen to incline somewhere else, then give there. Because you're learning about the power of generosity. You're learning about the impact generosity can have on your mind and have on your heart. If you give when it feels natural. So give when it feels good. That is always the best thing to do, and it's very powerful. Okay. And of course, when you give in a powerful way, then recollecting it afterwards is also very easy. If you give and you feel really joyful when you give, then when you sit down later on and you try to remember it, it has been a very powerful impact on the mind. It comes back again very easily, right? So the idea is you feel joy when you give, and it's easy to recollect again afterwards. So then, when you think, when you reflect in this way, again, your mind is not obsessed by greed, hatred, and delusion. Right? So your mind, all these things disappear. Your mind is straight, based on generosity. When you think about these things, you have spiritual happiness. This is the point here. You have a spiritual pleasure inside. Maybe the word spiritual sounds a bit pretentious, but it's like a mental happiness, which is not related to the five senses, right? By spiritual, I don't mean anything fancy. I just mean a happiness inside, which comes, which is apart from the five senses. That's all I mean by that. It's a mental, pure mental happiness. And because of that, the senses don't matter so much anymore. Sensual pleasures tend to disappear. Anger and negativity, all that disappears as well. And delusion disappears to a large extent. And again, this whole thing happens. You get inspiration again. You get inspiration in the meaning because you understand the meaning of generosity. You understand its power. You get inspiration in the Dhamma because you see the teachings that support this, right? That inspiration, you get so inspired that again you feel gladness, you feel the joy, the rapture, and the whole thing takes you all the way to samadhi. The more powerful the generosity is, the further along it will take you, the deeper will be your samadhi. The more powerful your virtue in the same way, the deeper, further along it will take you on this natural path, and the deeper will be your meditation practice. So, there you are. That is how the recollection of these things work. And again, when you recollect your generosity, don't try too hard. Don't force it. If you force yourself to remember these things, it won't be so powerful, it won't really work, because the mind is too active, there's too much sense of self there perhaps, trying to remember these things. Let it be natural, just lean back and allow the sense of goodness to arise by itself, by remembering, allowing the memory to come by itself. That is the most powerful way of doing this. Okay, so, that is, we've been going on for an hour and a half already. It's amazing how fast this goes. So the purpose just of the things that I've been talking about this morning is to show you the connection between virtue and meditation. And this is such an important thing, and that's why I've been dwelling on this a lot. And this afternoon at 3 o'clock, we will continue with this discourse at 3 o'clock this afternoon. And then I will talk more about how to actually develop the virtue. Now we have been looking at the mechanics, how it kind of connects together. Next thing will be to look more in detail about how to develop the virtue. In particular, how to develop the mind in such a way that the mind is more virtuous. So that will be for this afternoon. In the meantime, please enjoy your meditation, chill out, have a nice lunch. And we'll see you again at 3 o'clock. Yeah. Let's pay our respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.